Welcome to the History Slam podcast from ActiveHistory.ca. Here is your host, Sean Graham.
Thank you, Adam. Welcome to History Slam, everybody. I am Sean Graham, coming at you today nearly live from Georgetown, Ontario, my hometown. And I've noticed over the past year, maybe two, that there seems to be more and more television shows and movies focusing on historical issues or set in the past. And maybe it's just me noticing it as opposed to there actually being an increase. But the popularity of these shows is undeniable. And today we're going to talk about three of these. First, we're going to talk about Downton Abbey. Then we're going to move to Titanic, Blood and Steel, the miniseries which the CBC finished airing early last month. And then we'll get into Lincoln, the movie, the Spielberg movie. So those are the three things we're going to be talking about today. And we start with a discussion of Downton Abbey, which isn't Downtown Abbey, which I thought it was for the past 2 years, which is crazy. And we welcome in my cousin Megan Sanderson. Hey, Megan.
Hi, how are you?
Thanks for doing this.
No problem.
So the show Downton Abbey, you're a fan.
Yes.
Probably the biggest fan who I know.
Okay.
of the show.
Yes.
And you've been talking about it to myself, Scotty, who's coming up a bit later.
Yep.
And so we watched a few episodes, but basically, what's the premise of the show?
So I would say it's an aristocratic family living upstairs in Downton Abbey, which is kind of like a castle, I guess, like a big old, you know, house, I guess, just really big. And then the downstairs servants and housekeepers and maids and stuff, and their kind of relationships with each other and their goings-on every day and what happens in society and that kind of thing.
Right, so it's not so much, like, it just happens to take place at this one place. But this could really be, the idea is it could be any estate.
Yes, for sure.
In England.
Yeah, definitely.
And it's set, so the show starts in 1912?
Yes, just they find out the Titanic has sunk, so they had family on the Titanic that they assume are now dead. And then that starts this whole story of now there needs to be another heir to the money that is in his family.
And so it goes, and right now, so season three is about to start. No one in this room has, of course, seen season three.
No,
because it hasn't started. It hasn't aired yet.
No.
And it's supposed to start now.
It's aired in England already.
Right.
So some people in England have seen it.
Yeah.
But
all of our English listeners.
Yes, it starts in January here.
Okay.
Yeah.
And so season two ends with the end of the first war, or around the end of the first, like, because season two takes place on the back, with the backdrop of the war.
Yes. So I'm pretty sure it ends around, like, the war ends before season two ends, and then there's a Christmas special that they do. A Christmas special. So it's a little longer episode, and it's more of what happened at Christmas, and there's relationship, you know, final pieces of relationships come together. And,
right. Like any good season finale.
Yes, of course.
Okay, so now, this show takes place in the early 20th century.
Yes.
And obviously some of this is used as a for plot purposes, like with the Titanic and like with the war.
Yeah.
But how much of the show would you say is really historical drama, whereas the events of the past are really depicted in a way that's somewhat accurate, versus a drama that just happens to be set in the early 20th century?
I would say, yeah, a lot of it is like a romantic, you know, relationship, soap opera type. Right. But at the same time, there is, like you said, the war, and there's, you know, how society works at that time. So your class system and your, you know, these people aren't supposed to do certain things, or how they dress and how they eat and, you know, dinner parties they have and how they enter or have guests in their house and they have to do that kind of thing. So
it's a little bit of...
It's a little bit of both. I'm sure it could be any family in that time period or living in an estate like that could have the same kind of relationships going on.
Right, because the sense I got is that, I mean, you know, it's, how is it different from like the OC or any of these shows where it's just like it's all about these love interests and people are in love with each other but they can't get together and then everyone's with someone else and
true,
like,
and they're all cousins and
want
to need to marry, and a lot of, well, their main story is one of them, you know, they are cousins but one of them is the heir, but they want to keep it in the main family, but the girl can't be the heir, kind of thing.
Yeah, so, okay, so did I actually, because you mentioned cousins.
Yes.
I just saw Pride and Prejudice a few weeks ago, and you've seen Pride and Prejudice.
Yes.
The show, Downton Abbey, kind of reminds me of Jane Austen a yes. little bit in this, or at least with Pride and Prejudice, the idea of you need an heir, and it's only daughters now.
Yes.
And you want to keep it in the family, and this whole, the whole cousins thing is just so creepy.
Yes.
And,
but back then, I guess it was normal. It was accepted, I guess, in which society, which is still a little weird.
But. It is strange. So, yes. I mean, but, you know, Jane Austen is sort of held up as this major figure, this great writer.
Yeah.
But I don't know if Downton Abbey is going to be remembered in the same way, but what kind of distinction would you draw between the two, or if any?
It's very, I guess, very similar with, you know, this society, and I'm not sure, I don't quite remember how, if the Pride and Prejudice, like, was that family kind of socially upper class?
They're like, it was like, it seems like they were middle.
Middle class, and then Mr. Darcy, right?
Yeah, they were upper. And so then, like, his aunt or whatever didn't want him to marry the girl.
Well, see, and that's the other thing. Like, one of the, you know, Lady Crawley, the Maggie Smith character.
Yeah, who's brilliant.
Yes, she's awesome. One of the daughters ends up, you know, in a relationship with the driver, and he's from Ireland, and it's a big to-do, and, you know, they can't imagine having their daughter marry this man, because he's part of, you know, the lower class, and there's no way that could happen. But she's very progressive in her views of society and that kind of thing, and she's wanting to do everything against her upper class family that she's grown up in.
Because there's the one woman who has a child, and she, one of the servants has a kid out of wedding, and they cast her off, but she still brings food and stuff.
Yes, so that's like, also very no-no, cliche kind of thing. So they kind of shun her, and she's not to be working there. So it's interesting to see some of the characters very, you know, the older kind of characters in the show are very strict in their ways, and because it is going through the early 1900s into 1920s, where it is, everything's changing so rapidly, it's interesting to see where some characters are very set in their ways, whereas some of the younger characters, like Lady Sybil is one of the daughters, the same one with the driver, marrying the driver, she comes to dinner one night with pants on, and that's
scandal.
Yeah, scandalous. So, it's interesting to see the different changes they go through in society.
Yeah, so I guess, you know, if you look at it with the backdrop of stuff like the war and then the start of, you know, women's, like the voting movement
all
these sorts of things, so the rise of feminism.
Yeah.
And those sorts of things. I guess you could identify these trends.
Yes.
And if the writing's good, you won't notice them.
Yeah.
But they're there.
They are there, yeah.
So.
Yeah. I don't know, I think people just kind of, not that they relate to it in any way, like we can't relate to really that society system, I guess, in a way we can, but I don't know, I like the stories and the, you know, England old time, but that's just something I'm interested in, so.
Yeah. So out of 10, you would rank the show what?
A 10. Really liked it.
A 10. Wow. And the upcoming season?
I'm very
excited. What is your prediction? Yeah. Is it going to be good?
Hopefully, because it'll go through either just starting the 20s or into early 20s. So, you know, there's all that kind of thing. And it's funny because a lot of where they live in the area, the Downton Abbey where it is, and Ripley's another little town, and it's very kind of small town. But, you know, it's interesting to see when they do go into London and the big city, and to see the differences, whereas the big city, London, is kind of progressing again and, you know, all kinds of things. And then they go back to Downton. It's very, you are in the downstairs, you're the servant, you dress me, you know, take me to dinner and all that stuff. Whereas in London, it's kind of, you know, progressive and they can do whatever they want.
Right. So there's no marriages because of business arrangements.
No.
Which or is because a guy's dying and then you're just going to marry him so we can get his pension.
No, it's for...
And perhaps maybe the people are going to be better looking when they go to London.
That's true. Not your cousins.
Yeah. Which would be weird.
Yes.
All right, so season 3 starts soon if you want to go watch it. Megan highly recommends.
I do.
The show.
I do.
And, okay, plug what you're doing real quick because you guys are... Andy, your boyfriend, is sitting here too as we record this. You guys are doing something pretty cool. You guys work on cruise ships.
Yes. We do. We work for Royal Caribbean, so Andy is a singer in the cast, and I work with the kids. So we're going to Caribbean Islands leaving out of San Juan, and then we're going across to Europe, Scandinavia, Russia, Finland, all kinds of stuff. So
good stuff.
Traveling, yeah.
Cool. Andy, what's your favorite song in any of your shows?
That's a tough question. My favorite song? Let's see.
To sing.
Well, one of the two shows we're doing has a plethora of great songs. We Will Rock You, We Are the Champions by Queen, Somebody to Love by Queen, a whole Elton John section with Saturday Night's All Right for Fighting, Don't Let the Sun Go Down on Me. I can't pick just one. They're all great.
It's too hard.
Yeah, but I love it. Yeah.
Good stuff. Good stuff. Well, thank you guys for doing this.
No problem.
Okay, and with that, we shift to Montreal. I made it to Montreal just like that. That's good travel time. And recently, the CBC put on a 12-part miniseries that they purchased from a company over in Ireland that aired in Ireland and the BBC. I think it was on the BBC back in the last spring, and the CBC aired it over the fall, called Titanic: Blood and Steel, 12-part miniseries. And to talk about this one, a guy who knows more about television, watches more television than anybody else who I know, it's my brother Scott. Hey, Scotty.
Sean, good to be here.
thanks for doing this.
Yeah, no problem. I'm excited to talk about TV.
Oh, good. As you always are.
I always am.
Yeah. So, Titanic, Blood and Steel. As I said, 12-part miniseries. Takes place in Belfast between, I think it starts in 1908 or 1909, and it goes up until the Titanic sets sail in April of 1912. Now, there's a lot going on in this show.
A lot. It's very broad in context.
Yeah.
And it doesn't exactly nail anything down, as I'm sure we'll talk about.
Right. Okay, so I identified like 7 themes here, I think.
Okay.
We got unions.
Big theme. Big themes, unions.
The Fenians and home rule.
Yep.
The ideas of like proper society.
Okay.
With the whole Kitty Carlton storyline.
Okay, yep.
You have Mark Muir as like a guy. And his, like, 8 different things that he's trying to do. You have Nev Campbell being blackmailed. And this all takes place against the backdrop of the Titanic being built.
Right. I'd say this is a story more about society at the time. Mm-hmm. Using the Titanic as... the building of the Titanic as a backdrop, like you say. It's less important. You know, the setting is important. But it's more about society at the time rather than...
uh-huh.
About the building of the Titanic.
Right. That's just a device to keep everything together.
Exactly.
Yeah. Okay, so let's start. I mean, let's start with the union storyline.
Okay.
Because it's the one that happens first. It sort of resolves itself.
Right.
Before the rest of them. So you enter in 1908 or 1909, wherever you're entering, and the shipyard where they're going to build the Titanic is undergoing this union movement, and it's led by this guy, Michael McCann, who we're introduced to in that first episode. And he gets in with the union leader who comes into Belfast, and they're trying to start a union, and they're agitating for it. And like it just doesn't feel like that's that much of a struggle. It seems as though they come in and everyone, at least in the shipyard, is on board.
Yes. One of the interesting things I found about the union subplot, Michael McCann, as you say, is one of the riveters in the shipyard. And, you know, he's not really sure how his feelings about his work fit in with the rest of the country and the world at large.
Uh-huh.
And upon meeting the pro-union guy, whose name is Jim Larkin, he finds a sort of common connection with this guy, and he sees what stirs up the feelings inside of him, and he becomes the leader of the workers in the shipyard. And you're right, it's strange because there's no struggle, really. The purveyor of Harland and Warts is painted as quite sympathetic to the union.
Yeah.
It's really strange because he's a lord and, you know, he's a Protestant.
Yeah.
But he's very sympathetic to the Catholics and very sympathetic to the workers.
Yeah.
And so...
and you don't really get his backstory as to why he would be like this.
No.
Like, there's no reason to it.
He's the outlier amongst the board of directors.
Yeah.
And so the fight for the union in that context is not really that important at the shipyard, whereas at the suppliers around Belfast, at the coal company, for example, it's a lot more hardline. And that's a more interesting story, I think, than, oh, we'd like fairer wages, yeah, and we're going to go on strike. And they're on strike for, you know, you don't really know the timeline in the series, which is another thing we should talk about.
Yeah,
but it seems like a few days.
Mm-hmm.
They're on strike, and then the boss comes and says, okay, well,
what do you want?
We'll pay you more if you guarantee us not to go on strike.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it doesn't make any sense. Like, it's like Peary, who's the head of the shipyard.
Yeah.
He's more fighting with his board than with the workers, and it doesn't really feel genuine in any way.
No, it doesn't to me at all.
And then, like, they have the one protest, and the one guy gets killed, and everyone is sort of upset about that, but it's almost like that's just used to prompt a later storyline.
Yeah, Michael McCann's brother-in-law getting murdered by the British Army.
Yeah,
during a protest, it really is a plot device to further other events down the road,
mm-hmm,
and it doesn't seem like the Union storyline is well developed at all.
No, it doesn't play very well, I don't think.
The production overall seemed to me to be very pro-Union.
Yes.
As someone watching it.
Someone's review was that it wasn't a historically accurate piece. It was a piece that was used, that they thought is being used, or putting today's values on it, or at least whoever made the show, their values, placing it in early 20th century Belfast.
I'd agree with that.
Yeah.
And their values being reflected primarily by Lord Peary.
Yes. But it's not like he really wins at the same time, Lord Peary.
Overall, no. Well, I guess we'll talk a little more about the, you know, tying up all the loose ends of the series. But mm-hmm, no, Lord Peary doesn't win, but his views are the most sympathetic.
Right.
As a viewer watching it, you feel most sympathetic towards him.
Yeah, that's true. So the next theme there, and it sort of starts right around the same time as this whole Union arc stars to go away. I guess the one thing we should say is that the Union arc, they try to continue it because Michael McCann runs in the election.
Yes.
They have an election, and he loses, and he gets beat up, and then he just goes away, and we don't know why he goes away.
Yeah, he runs as a representative for Parliament,
yeah,
for the Labour Party.
Yes.
And is defeated, and then intimidated by some thugs, and then disappears until,
yeah,
the last episode. That's about, there's 12 episodes, I think it's maybe the 7th or 8th episode.
Yeah.
The election happens, he gets bullied,
and he's gone.
And he disappears for the rest of the series.
Yeah, without any explanation.
I didn't even notice he was gone, because they just never mentioned his story again. So, yeah, it was quite strange.
Yeah, and that sort of leads into the next storyline of the Fenian, and Home Rule. Because that plays in this election, and one of the reasons he loses is because the Labour Party is in favor of Home Rule, and all the Protestants think that that's a bad idea. And
yeah,
they have the slogan of Home Rule is Rome Rule. So they think that the Pope is just going to take over control with Home Rule, and the Catholics would take over control, and that's not good. But the Fenian storyline really centers on Michael McCann's brother, Connor, going off and joining the Fenians and,
right,
finding some guns and killing some people. And I don't think this plays out at all. I think it fills 40 minutes of the series that they felt they needed to fill.
Yeah.
The Home Rule stuff, okay, fine, fits into the rest. Him going off and joining the Fenians has nothing to do with anything else.
It's shoehorned in,
yeah,
for sure, but it's an important part of what's going on in Ireland at the time.
Mm-hmm.
So it's important to talk about it, for sure.
Yeah.
But I agree with you that it wasn't well portrayed in this series. You could probably do an entire series based on the tensions between Catholics and Protestants in Ireland at the time. And it's pretty well known now that Northern Ireland is where the majority of the tensions were, because that's where most of the Protestants are.
Mm-hmm.
And even today, that's the case. And Northern Ireland remains part of the United Kingdom, with the majority of Protestants there.
Mm-hmm.
Or maybe not a majority, but it's the Protestant part of Ireland. And so what's going on in Belfast between the Protestants and the Catholics is, to my mind, the most important political backdrop to the series.
Okay.
The Union stuff mostly hinges on a Catholic versus Protestant idea, because the Protestants are the bosses and the Catholics are the workers.
Right.
And so those undertones aren't really well explored in this series, but they're always there. And that's another thing that fuels the Union storyline,
mm-hmm,
to some degree. Now, with the Fenian storyline, as you mentioned, Michael McCann's brother is the one who goes and joins up with them,
yeah,
in some very clandestine meeting that they have on the streets of Belfast. He's being followed, and then all of a sudden,
they're like, "Do you want to be a Fenian?"
Poke out of some dark corner, and I've heard you're the man that sympathizes with us.
Yeah,
it seems sort of strange. As you say, they go out to the country, uncover a cache of weapons that they've bought from German. It turns out, at this point in time, there are signs pointing towards tension between Germany and England. We all know that there was a war a couple of years later, and the Germans had already undertaken some steps to try and create unrest in Ireland, create some division in the British military with having to devote some resources to Ireland, and could thus make them weaker on the continent.
Mm-hmm.
But where the story goes, ultimately, I don't know.
Like, it doesn't make sense. He goes off, and he does, like, one raid or whatever, and there's some people who are within the group who are actually like double agents, and he kills them, and then he comes home and he gets found out and he gets shot, and it's not even clear when he gets shot if he dies the next episode.
He gets shot right before the end credits for one of the episodes,
and that's the end of the show.
And it comes back, and the mention of him is that he's gone now at first, and you're not sure if he's dead or if he's wounded, and then eventually, maybe later in the next episode, they talk about him being dead.
Yeah. Well, once his girlfriend gets pregnant.
Right.
Then it becomes an issue. Oh, he's dead, and she's pregnant.
Yeah.
Or I guess she was pregnant all along, but they find out that she's pregnant.
Yeah.
And that takes like a half hour of the next episode, and it doesn't make any sense.
Yeah, it's not well resolved, like you say. It's not quite clear. I guess it's important to make mention of it, but it didn't really fit into the flow of the overall narrative of the show.
Right. And okay, so the next thing then is the character of Mark Muir. He ties into everything else that's going on in some capacity. So Mark Muir is the central character of the show. He's played by Kevin Zegers. I guess that's the Canadian content. And his storyline is that he's a metallurgist, and he was in America, and he gets hired to work on the Titanic. And so he goes to Belfast. And we find out that he was from Belfast, and his father is there. And basically, the rest of the conflict in the show that doesn't have to do with the McCanns is all prompted by Mark Muir.
Mark Muir is the protagonist in the series. Mark Muir is the one that you're supposed to identify with and like. The emotions that you feel when you're watching it is mostly based on the Mark Muir storylines. He's a pretty compelling character.
Uh-huh.
I'd say he was one of the two or three best acted characters on the show.
Yeah.
Like you say, he comes to Belfast, comes back to where he's from to work.
But we don't know that until like episode 3. They hint at it.
Definite hints at it.
Yeah.
So we should just come out and ruin Mark Muir's secret and say Mark Muir, the character, grew up in Belfast, went to study in London, worked for the Admiralty.
Yep.
Went to New York, got his doctorate in meddling.
Yes.
I guess. While he was in New York, changed his name to Mark Muir.
Yes.
Went back to Belfast. Now, the reason he had to change his name is because he grew up as Marcus Malone. Very Catholic name.
Yes.
And at the time, if he'd wanted to go back to Belfast and work as an executive, he couldn't be Catholic.
Right.
So he hid his past. And him hiding his past drives much of the series.
I don't think it does. I disagree.
Really?
Yeah. It drives episodes 3 and 4, and maybe 5, but like once everyone knows he used to be a Catholic, then it doesn't matter anymore.
I think it always matters.
That he hid his past?
That he was a Catholic.
I don't think it does.
He got fired.
And then he got hired back.
Yes.
10 minutes later.
Solely on the recommendation of J.P. Morgan.
Right, and J.P. Morgan just says, like, who cares? The city is stupid. And then he walks away.
Sure. But there's another aspect.
And Muir gets hired back and no one seems to care except for the one guy, Andrews, who works as a lower level employee who supervises the women who are like the office staff. And then he's upset, but who cares what he thinks? Like, well, it's not like he really comes back to play some sort of big role. Like, the fact that he's Catholic is important in episodes 3 through 6. And then that's it.
Perhaps the fact that he's Catholic, but his hidden past.
Yes.
Is a driver in the show.
Right, but that's just to open another plot point.
Perhaps, but it does, to my mind, drive it. So this other point that we're talking about is once he comes back to Belfast, he finds his father, who is a drunk, and his father tells him that you have to leave, Mark. You have to get out of here because there's another man that's after him who happens to be the father of Muir's ex-girlfriend.
Ex-girlfriend. That's a way to put it. She's dead.
Okay.
His deceased girlfriend.
Okay. So when
they didn't break up.
When he left Belfast, he left a girl there and
she died.
She died. He was told that she died of tuberculosis, but in fact she died in childbirth, which he didn't even know that she had a child.
Right.
The child survived, and then most of his motivations focus on trying to find this child.
Right.
Until the very last episode, he's still trying to find this child.
Yeah.
Which is a frustrating development in the show because his drive to find his child comes in direct conflict with the primary love interest in the story, which is him and an Italian immigrant woman.
Sophia.
Whose name is Sophia, who also works at the shipyard as a drafter?
Yes. Yeah.
Draftsman?
Like that. She draws all of his experiments.
A sketch, yeah.
Yeah, that's what she does.
So the conflict that's created there, I guess, is sort of the reason to keep that storyline going. But
yeah, I mean, yeah, like Mark and Sophia get together before it comes out that he's Catholic. And so the concern for her initially is that he's not Catholic.
So that they'll be...
They won't be able to be together. But as soon as he's Catholic, then it doesn't matter anymore. And I think the best part of the series is when they're together.
Yeah.
Right? Those episodes like 7, 8, when they're like just in full on affair mode. Like that, I think that's the best part.
I agree.
Of the series.
The two actors definitely had a lot of chemistry together.
Yeah.
Their scenes that they shared on screen were really in stark contrast to a lot of the rest of the acting that happened in the series, which wasn't all bad. It was just a little more stilted. There wasn't as much chemistry between the actors. I found the scenes where there was a lot of action going on were okay.
Mm-hmm.
Like the riot that we talked about before, yeah. The union stuff was pretty good. But the best acting was when these two were on screen together.
Yeah.
And it was frustrating to me as a viewer to hear Sophia saying to Mark, why don't we just be together? Why don't we leave Belfast? Mm-hmm. Leave all this Catholic-Protestant strife behind?
Yeah.
And he had to keep replying, no, I can't. I have to find this daughter.
Yeah. And because it seems like the daughter is there to keep him in Belfast because he has to continue to work on that Titanic. Because he, as the character, he gets frustrated with the politics of working on the Titanic when he's saying, hey, it's not safe.
Yeah.
And they're saying, no, we're not going to do that. And it seems like from a character standpoint, professionally, he's so frustrated that he would just leave. But when he gets to that point, he has this daughter, so he has to stay. And that's the only reason why the daughter, I think, is introduced, because otherwise there's really no reason for this daughter to be there, who we never see.
Of course we do.
Well, not really. I mean, they end an episode. So the plot is that the daughter was given up for adoption, and the people who adopted her are poor now because the husband died.
Yes.
So it's just her and her adoptive mother. And we see the end of one episode that they're in some small little room and they're cold, and the mother's saying it's going to be okay. So we see her then, and then we see them at the end of the show on the ship.
And you see her working in the coal factory as well.
Right. So that's all we see. I mean, but it's not like they're integral.
No, they're not.
Right? It's just there to keep him there. There needs to be a motivation for the characters that want to stay in Belfast when Sophia is saying, like, she gets an offer to go to school in London, and she wants to go. So there's a way for him to say no. Like, I have to stay in Belfast, and that's what it is.
And I think that's what it was used for, but I don't think it was that effective. It was more frustrating to me. To my mind, a more plausible explanation could have been just his passion for the Titanic, which came across in the very first episode when he talked to J.P. Morgan, and he said, I know more about metal and shipbuilding than anyone. And Morgan said to him, so you believe you're the man to make this happen? And he said, I believe I'm the only man that can do it. He was passionate about the project at the start. And like you said, he got disillusioned along the way. But I think if a better plot device to keep him in Belfast would have been just his passion for building the ship, despite all of his previous setbacks.
No, it's true. But I think his frustration with the process is mirrored nicely by Thomas Andrews, who is sort of the secondhand man at the shipbuilding yard. And initially they don't get along because Andrews is saying no to all these ideas, and then but it's played out that Andrews himself used to have these same ideas and say, hey, we need to make things safer, but just within the day-to-day operation of shipbuilding, you can't do it for financial reasons. And so the two of them actually connect over this and they have become friends. But once it gets to the point where the captain of the, because the Olympic, it's the same company in the show builds the Olympic.
Right. They build the, they have a contract to build the three ships with White Star.
Right. So the Olympic, the crash of the Olympic, which of course actually happened.
Yeah.
They have the hearings over it and whether or not they should, what they should do, who's at fault. And basically there's an arrangement between this Peary and Winston Churchill to sell out the captain of the ship.
Right.
And that's when he really gets disillusioned. And that's when, so none of his ideas are being accepted to make the ship safer. And he just saw how things really work. And any innocence he had about the purity of the process is gone. So at that point, it seems like he wants to leave and he's ready to leave. But his daughter, he's like, oh, there's a new lead on my daughter. I have to stay. I don't think you could sustain this passion for the ship throughout the whole series.
Maybe not. And my opinion is I found it frustrating.
Mm-hmm.
That, oh God, he just keeps wanting to find this daughter that he didn't even know he had one, for
right.
starters. He doesn't even know if he's going to be able to do anything about it, even if he does find her. Like, all right.
Yeah.
And, you know, I don't know if that should be up to him to decide that I'm going to insert myself into the life of this person just because.
Yeah, and does he even want to insert himself into her life as opposed to just say, hey, I'm your real father, see you later?
Yeah. That seems really strange to me.
Yeah.
And so I guess I was more rooting for Mark and Sophia versus Mark and his unknown 10-year-old daughter.
Yeah, for sure. And I will say this, too, about the Mark and Sophia thing. The two people who are playing these characters are relatively attractive individuals, and they have love scenes, and all we see is shoulders.
Well, Sean.
It's somewhat disappointing.
I don't know if the series was meant to titillate as much as it was to... Tell a story,
yeah.
But I sympathize with your position.
The other thing we have to talk about is... Okay, we could talk about this whole Kitty Carlton thing, but that's just too weird. It doesn't work at all.
Yeah, this sort of upper class...
Yeah, this upper class idea. So her father is on the board of this Harlan and Warts. She gets together with Mark and is found out, and she's supposed to be engaged to this other guy. Or
now,
she is engaged.
When you say got together, you mean slept with.
Yes.
Right. Just making that clear.
Yeah. And she gets found out, and then she gets sent away by her daughter, or by her father, to London, because she doesn't want to marry this guy.
Goes to London, reinvents herself as some sort of actress, puts on a stage show, which you never see. You don't really know what it is, but you get the feeling it's some sort of burlesque show. Then becomes so famous over the span of, I don't know,
a year,
that... By the end of the series, she's on board the Titanic, sailing for New York. She's going to open her show in New York.
She's going to be in movies.
Discovered by a film director.
Yep.
She's going to go be in the silent films,
yep.
I suppose.
Yep.
No talkies by then.
Nope.
So she was an interesting character at the start to provide a little conflict.
They didn't really know what to do with her. And the only thing I could think of is that, I mean, there's this undercurrent of feminism going on throughout the show with, like, Sophia and wanting to go to school, and she goes to a feminist meeting and, like, the right to vote and everything.
Mm-hmm.
And perhaps the Kitty character is seen as a very feminist character, and that she doesn't submit to her father's demands. And she goes off and she becomes a self-sustaining woman. Whereas her mother, when she's trying to talk, her mother tries to talk her into marrying this Ashley guy. And she's saying, you can marry him, you can still have an affair on the side. Basically, that's what I did. And just sort of fall into line. And she's saying, no, I'm not going to do that. I'm going to go assert myself and be who I want to be. And that's sort of what she says at the end of the series.
Yeah.
Is that I'm happy now with who I am. And I think that does sort of mirror the Sophia character and her emergence in a different capacity.
I agree. The feminism line is quite a prominent one throughout the series. And I think it's one of the things they do pretty well, is portray the rise of feminism, the suffrage movement. And I'm overall pretty satisfied with how that was done.
Yeah. And then to a similar extent, I guess the Neve Campbell character is also a feminist character. And she's an independent woman. She's a newspaper writer who works basically for J.P. Morgan as a publicist. And she's not in a lot of episodes. She's in the beginning. And she comes over to Belfast towards the end to publicize the launching of the Titanic. And to me, this is where the series, at the end, starts to just go off the rails.
Really off the rails. It made me think, hey, we've got this actress that people know. Do we have to do something with her?
Yeah, because she's not serviced when she's there at the beginning.
No.
Right?
She acts as a liaison between Mark Muir, who she knew from London, I think, or perhaps just from New York, and J.P. Morgan.
Yeah.
She's the one that provides the introduction, which spurs the series.
Right, but you could find any actress to do that.
Sure.
But if it's Neve Campbell, you have to give her a bigger part.
Right. So then what we find out towards the end when she comes to Belfast, her family is German. She left Germany when she was a child, but her brother is currently imprisoned in Germany for...
Gambling debts.
Gambling debts, okay.
So the guy offers to help him get out of jail if she does some covert spying for the Germans.
Right. Her job is to steal some plans for the shipbuilding company's wartime operations plan.
Yeah.
And so she goes and uses her spy camera, which I found laughable because she had to set it up and sort of tilt the documents on this special plate, set it up, like push the button to take the picture in a really old-timey camera way.
Yeah.
And I thought it was kind of a funny...
well, she had time.
Old-timey spy camera, because it takes probably 20 minutes to set up.
Yeah.
So, not sure how useful it would be in covert operations, but she does it, and then her brother is not released.
Yeah.
And she's forced to do more stuff. And it seemed to me like she was always portrayed as being quite smart, quite capable, very progressive woman. But then to just assume, I assume they're going to let my brother go if I provide these things. Like, it seemed very out of character.
Yeah, and it also seemed strange that she seemed to be completely estranged from her whole family.
Right.
And so she's taking this huge risk. And not even just, like, in terms of her job or whatever. Like, she could die doing this.
Mm-hmm.
For someone who apparently she hasn't had any communication with in 30 years.
Yeah, it seemed very strange. There were no stakes to this storyline, which made it fall flat.
Yeah, it was just like, there's a war coming. I'm like, great, I know there's a war coming.
I read that book.
Yeah, like, and so for me, that's sort of where it goes off. Like, that whole storyline doesn't work. And it's part of the end of the series just isn't good.
No.
Like, and episodes 11 and 12 are just not good. And that's when this whole storyline takes place. I mean, Neve Campbell, she's also there to service the Sophia character and get her to New York.
Yes.
She gets the Sophia character a job in New York, which prompts them all to get on the Titanic. And so that services that. But this whole German spying thing just doesn't fit within the rest of the series. I mean, you could have incorporated this oncoming war in a much better way.
It did seem like it was a bit of filler.
Yeah.
You know, padding the episodes.
Yeah. Okay, so then the series ends. They're all everyone is on the Titanic, basically.
Yeah.
There's a few people who are left behind, but all your principals are on the Titanic, and we end with Mark Muir walking past his daughter, who he doesn't know is his daughter, and getting together with Sophia, because Sophia doesn't know he's on the ship, and she's really happy. And that's how we end. And, you know, my sense is that, okay, they're all going to die, but I read something else that the idea of the series is that we're left to wonder who will survive. Like, maybe Kitty does make it to New York, you know, or maybe Sophia makes it back. Maybe they have a Jack and Rose situation.
Ooh.
once the ship is going down.
Maybe.
And so maybe he dies and she goes on and she becomes successful or whoever. But, I mean, you could safely assume that none of the men are going to survive. But
yeah.
Maybe a couple of the women manage to survive.
Maybe. But it just seemed to me sort of depressing, you know?
Yeah.
And I sort of, probably around the middle of the series, I sort of saw that coming as the end.
Mm-hmm.
As sort of they're all going to be on the boat.
Yep.
Ship. But... one of the jokes throughout is that Neve Campbell's character keeps calling it Mark's passion for boats.
Yes.
And he always says, no, they're ships.
Yes.
But...
like our cousin Megan.
Right.
Who works on ships.
She works on the ships. Yes, you're right.
Not boats.
No. So it was just sort of a depressing end. And another small storyline that they shoehorned in the back third of the series was this guy Andrews, who's the number two at the shipyard, had a real passion for making sure that all ships the right number of lifeboats to make sure that every passenger could get on a lifeboat. And it seemed like the one thing that really stuck in his craw was, we've got to make sure that there's enough lifeboats for every person. And he was the only one that seemed to champion this idea. All the others were like, who cares? These boats are never going to sink.
Yeah.
Oh, whatever. Or it's going to cost us way too much. And so, you know, they they put that storyline in as a way of saying, like, we're not ignoring that there's not enough lifeboats on the Titanic.
Yeah, it's a factor.
Don't worry about it. But overall, a very depressing end to the series, knowing that these characters we've come to somewhat care about are all going to die.
Yeah.
Damn.
Yeah. So overall, like, I found episodes 1 and 2 not that good. And then through the middle, like, 3 through 8, it was, like, I would watch them at night, and, like, I'd be tired, and I'd say, I would probably have to go to bed. But in those, like, 5 episodes, it's like, I really want to watch the next one. And then I got to 9, and that feeling just went away. And 10, 11, 12, I watched because we were doing this. It's like, at this point, I'm not really too concerned about it. It really did fall flat. And I think one of the reasons it did is because... So the series takes place over 3 years. So obviously they have to skip ahead between episodes. But they don't tell you where you are at the start of the episode until the last one. And they're like, hey, it's April 1912. Like, okay, this ship is going to head off soon. Okay. But, you know, from episode, like, 8 to 9, I think it's 6 or 8 months or something. And they just don't tell you. Like, or the baby is, she gives birth in one episode. And then the next episode, it's like a year old. And that's the only indicator as to where you are. And but that doesn't, you can't, you don't even see the baby until like 20 minutes in, so you just don't know where you are in the series.
Yeah, there's a lot of different plot devices you can use to mark passages of time. You can use a sort of a subtitle that says, oh, this is the date. Or you can use, you know, a shot of a newspaper and then pan up. Or
You know, or even if you start each series and be that, or each episode and say, this is where we're supposed to be on schedule, and this is where we are, in the building. Like, you're talking about the building process anyway.
Sure, yeah.
Like, do that in the first 2 minutes, and then you can orient the viewers to where you are.
And, it's sort of a thing that is difficult when you're telling a story over such a long period of time.
Mm-hmm.
But I did find myself lost at some times about how far along are we? Why are these characters not talking to each other now? Why are they, like, what's different?
Yeah.
So that was a bit of a failing of the series. But Sean, I want to get your impressions overall of the series, because we've talked a lot about its shortcomings.
Yeah.
And would you recommend this series to someone who's interested in the Titanic or interested in that time period?
I think you'd have to be, as someone just generally watching TV, I would probably say no. But if you're interested in Titanic or even Ireland and Belfast in the early 20th century and or some of these issues with unions and stuff, then it's a good insight. I mean, the people who made it were from Belfast.
Yes.
So, I mean, they're making it as a history, not just of the Titanic, but a history of their city to a certain degree. So, I mean, if you lived in Belfast or if you were interested in Belfast, then yeah, that's I could see why it'd be an interesting series. But for someone in Canada who's not, if you're not interested in the Titanic at all, or in Ireland, the history of Ireland, say, I don't really, as a TV show, as just purely as a TV show, I don't think it's that great.
I'll disagree slightly. I think for a pure entertainment value, it's not bad.
Mm-hmm. Like, I can understand why the CBC aired it.
Yeah, me too. It's sort of fitting with this seemingly obsessive culture we have towards the Titanic.
Uh-huh. I don't know. 100 years.
Okay, 100 years, but it still seems like...
That's why they did it.
That's why the series was made.
Yeah.
Yeah, but I mean, why was the movie made in 1997?
Because they knew it could make $1 billion.
Right, because people love the Titanic.
Yeah.
And so, it's interesting. I found some of the episodes kind of dragged, but overall, I liked it.
Uh-huh.
I wouldn't put it among my top series of all time, that's for sure.
There's not really any rewatchability.
You know, maybe 6 out of 10, if I'm giving it a number.
Yeah, I'd probably go lower. I'd give it maybe 5.
Sure. But somewhere,
it's not terrible, but it's not great.
Decent.
Yeah.
It'll pass the time.
Yeah.
And I'm not sad I watched it.
Right.
So, that said, I mean, kudos to the people who made it for that.
Yeah.
We don't want to just bash them the whole time. No. One of the things that I noticed was the special effects.
Yeah.
Because obviously they can't build a huge ship.
No.
So, they were noticeable, but oftentimes I think that I'd rather they spend money on the actors and the costuming rather than on special effects and on the writers.
Yeah. I agree.
So in this case, the special effects were okay.
Passable.
No, they were noticeable, though. Like, you knew that, oh, there's a giant shot of a computerized version of the Titanic.
Yeah, and when they put it into the water and all that, it's not the greatest looking thing ever, but...
No. Which is, I think...
But given that it's not central to the story, I mean, there's the backdrop.
But one of the ways that they marked the passage of time, as we just talked about, was...
They try to do it through the construction, but it's not clear.
They do it a lot through showing establishing shots of where they are in the building process. So they've got...
But once the hull is built, I mean, then they're all just working on the inside, and I don't think it's that effective.
You're right. Once the hull is built, it's not as effective. But I found it useful in the first six or seven episodes.
Yeah. All right. So overall, we have a medium review.
Yeah, middling review. You know, if you're interested in the Titanic, watch it. You probably won't be sorry.
Yeah.
If not, you can miss it.
All right, very good. Well, thanks, Scotty.
You're welcome.
All right, and you can actually follow Scott on Twitter, @ScottLikesTV, if you wanted to hear his rantings about the Bills and the Blue Jays.
Bills, Blue Jays, sometimes some TV shows.
All right, real quick, over-under on Blue Jays wins at 87.5.
Over.
By a lot?
4 or 5.
Wow.
Yeah.
So they're going to make the playoffs.
You know it.
All right.
You heard it here. Second.
Sounds good, Scotty. Thanks for doing this, bud.
All right, Sean, thanks.
And we are back in Georgetown, final part of the podcast. Lincoln just came out, new Spielberg movie, obviously, about Abraham Lincoln. And Dave Hyde is here. We have just seen the movie. Hey, Dave.
How are you doing, Sean?
I'm doing well. Well, not as good as I was 3 hours ago, but, you know, we're hanging in there, I guess. So we literally just saw the movie. We're back from the theater taping this. And we talked a little bit in the car on the way back, and... Okay, first of all, our feelings about the movie are obviously partly going to be influenced because we watched it in the worst theater ever. The seats were terrible.
It was too hot.
Way too hot. The guy next to us was looking on his phone the whole time,
which and I found spilling into your seat a little
super
bit.
Super distracting. He almost crushed my Coke when he sat down.
I believe it was a Sprite.
Well, you know, same thing. Same company. But, so it was just a terrible theater, and that may have
made the
length
of the movie extra uncomfortable.
Yes. This is a 2 hour, and at least 2.5 hours.
At least.
Maybe a little bit more. You can never tell, because the movie time says 7:30, but you don't know when it actually starts.
No, because there was a good 17 minutes of...
at least.
...of action trailers.
Yeah, the trailers did not match up to the...
No.
So the movie, we're sitting there, I'm thinking it's going to be an action movie about the Civil War, and, like, Lincoln swings in and starts beating people up based on the trailers. The movie is somewhat mistitled. If you think it's a biopic of Lincoln, it's not a biopic of Lincoln.
No.
And so you said that a better title would be The 13th Amendment.
The 13th Amendment, yes, correct.
Yeah, so the movie basically follows Lincoln after his re-election in 1864... but before his inauguration in 1865, and it's the lame duck Congress, and he's trying to get the 13th Amendment passed. And that's basically your movie.
Yes.
Overall, now you mentioned this in the car, you thought at the start of the movie his motivations for wanting to get the amendment passed weren't clear.
Correct. The way that the movie portrays it is that the passing was the only thing that mattered to him, and that he would have kept the war going for a prolonged period of time, ending lives unnecessarily just so that he could kind of have his name stamped in history.
Mm. And that's how it's portrayed early on. And,
correct.
And there's the option presented to him that you could just end this war now, and he doesn't do it, and it's not clear why.
Right. He just sits quietly, which he is early on in the movie, very quiet, and then changes his tune later on to telling very lengthy stories.
Yes.
But early on, yes, he's this very, very quiet, lanky individual who just sits awkwardly in a chair and listens to everyone talk around him, and nothing is resolved.
Right. I think my guess is that they're trying to make him as a very contemplative figure who later is able to assert himself because he's considered all options. This is my guess.
Yes. That they're building the character, clearly.
Right.
Yes.
And okay, so he does this, and they move forward, and basically the plot of the movie, so much as there is a plot, is they need 20 Democrats to vote with the Republicans, because Lincoln is a Republican,
on the 13th Amendment to get the 2/3 in the House. It's already passed the Senate, and they need to get the House. And basically, it's the behind-the-scene wrangling of him trying to get it. And it starts out with a very almost covert operation.
Yes.
With these three sketchy guys. With James Spader is there. Who's... And James Spader, he's pretty good in the role, have to say. But yeah, so they're really sort of out of sight trying to pull these strings.
Yeah, as you said, covertly behind the scenes, doing what they can, offering Republican jobs to Democrats if they are to vote the proper way. Mm-hmm. In the very near future, they will be offered a very nice job, and that is their only bargaining chip early on.
Yes, because they're going after the guys who lost in the November election before the new session starts.
Correct.
So these guys are going to be unemployed.
Yes.
It's, you know, and I guess it makes a comment about the way the political wranglings work, because a lot of guys, when they lose an election, they immediately have a job somewhere.
Right. Like, even if they jump ship.
Yeah, and so it's not hard for them to find jobs. So there's clearly some sort of a commentary there, but it's also real. I mean, it happens.
Yes.
So it's not that far-fetched. And then, so we go on, and Lincoln, throughout this process, become more and more involved in trying to convince these guys to get on board. Now, what did you think of this, of the way that Daniel Day-Lewis plays Lincoln? And I think he does a pretty good job, but like, how did you feel about this progression of the Lincoln character, given that the movie takes place over 4 months?
I think that the character almost becomes more comical. Like, they win you over as this contemplative character that you just mentioned, and by the middle of the movie, he's telling these lengthy stories that he's using really big words that make him sound really smart, but have underlying comical tones, and he's just almost like a comedian. Mm-hmm. And is offering comic relief in this very, very serious political movie.
Yeah, it's very anecdotal at times.
Yes. So the Lincoln character, by the end of the movie, is no longer seen as this person who is putting a lot of thought into his actions, so much as he maybe perceives himself as won his point. So he's able to just kind of walk around as the big shot, and actually calling himself out at one point as the president of the United States of America. And I guess almost holding that power over everyone else.
Yeah, I agree. It gets a little preachy towards the end. It seems like it's really two different characters. And I guess it's somewhat justified in that he just did pass this amendment, which he has now based his whole administration on. So I could see why he would get a little chesty in that respect.
The one character development that I think they should have done a little bit more on was it was Ulysses Grant who mentions that in 1 year you have aged 4 years, and in terms of makeup they did a phenomenal job making him look 4 years older.
Yeah.
But in terms of character development, you don't get to see that.
No.
Because he has one or two speeches and that's it. So you don't get to really see that character development, where I think a little bit more time spent on that would really have shown the... You talked about the short period of time that the movie takes place, but you could at least see how a character could change so drastically.
Because, I really like the way it opens, is that he's in a camp with Union soldiers, and four soldiers are there, and they're talking to him, and there's two white soldiers, two black soldiers... And the white soldiers say, "We saw you at Gettysburg." And he asks, "Could you hear what he said?" And between the four of them, they then recite the Gettysburg Address. And you see Lincoln there is obviously they're showing that he's already held up as a...
He has the people. That was a big message in the whole movie.
Yeah, he has the people on his side. And so you can see how he's growing into this. And maybe it's him, you know, understanding that now he's... Because he's just coming out of this election... That he's been given this new mandate, and he really wants to use it. So maybe it's him growing into this role, and the understanding that he has to do it quickly, before the new session takes place, and him learning how to do this in this short period of time. That could be part of it.
The kind of learning how to run before you learn how to walk type approach.
Like because he has such a short amount of time to do it, and maybe he's just becoming more assertive by necessity.
Yeah,
than anything else, and he's feeling the pressure.
not only from his cabinet, and you see it a few times, that his cabinet's really pressuring him or pulling him in different directions, but also from his wife, who's played, I think, played really nicely by Sally Fields.
Yes.
I thought she did a really good job. And with Mary Todd Lincoln being a little off the wall and all over the place. And you really see that in a couple scenes. One of the main conflicts between Lincoln and Mary Todd Lincoln is the son. The older son that Lincoln has, who is off in law school in Boston. And he comes home and he wants to join the army. And neither of his parents want him to. And the character is played by Joseph Gordon-Levitt, who I'm a fan of. But
I don't think that
he doesn't need to be there.
No. An actor of that caliber did not fit the role. The role did not.
The role, I don't even think, I think it's a character that you could almost be off scene, like off screen the whole time. Mm-hmm. It's a character who is, I think, way over-serviced given his importance to the story.
Correct.
And it seems like the only thing I can see that he's there for is to service the plot or the conflict between Lincoln and Mary Todd Lincoln.
Correct. But in any dialogue that the two of them share in the bedroom or in the drawing room, you could easily just address him by name as opposed to having an on-screen character, as you've said.
Yeah. And the reason we say this is because the movie is too long.
Yes.
If the movie was 40 minutes shorter and they kept the character, the son character, then fine, the son is there. But the fact that the movie is 2 hours and 40 minutes, that guy, he doesn't need to be there.
Yes, if you're looking for things to cut out of a movie,
he's an easy cut.
It's a very easy decision. There are no scenes that he is in that draw any remarkable connection to the movie.
No, he shows up, he talks with his little brother, he talks with his mom, mm-hmm. talks with his dad ignores him, they go to an army hospital, he gives his typical son speech about how he's going to do what he wants and you can't tell me what to do. And then you see him with Ulysses S. Grant a couple times, and because that's where he gets posted, and that's it.
Yeah.
It's just not necessary for him to be there.
Are maybe they trying to portray the importance or the power that Lincoln had by being able to post him so that he lets his son have that position in the war?
Maybe, but like he says, like Lincoln says when he's talking to his son, I'm the commander-in-chief, even if you join the army, you're not going to fight.
Yeah.
I can do whatever I want.
Right. So and even at that, it could have been D-level actor that plays the character, and he has one scene when he's standing beside Grant, and he addresses him as Lincoln's son. Yeah.
Or you can even have the blowout with his father.
You could do that
too. You could still do that, and you just don't need this other thing where it almost feels like because it's somebody of note that they need to give him the screen time, which doesn't serve the rest of the movie.
Correct.
It's just,
I was going to say, what about the slavery card that we were talking about?
Oh, yeah, so we talked about this as well. There's black servants in the White House, and you see two of them, and there's this one scene where the son, Lincoln's little son, who's, I don't know, 8 years old or give or take, whatever he is, asks the male servant if he was beaten when he was a slave, and the guy says, no, I was born free. And then the female servant comes in and says, ask her, and she says, yeah, I was beaten with a shovel younger than you are. And she almost says it as a throwaway comment and then starts talking to Lincoln. Now, you and I have differing opinions on this.
Right. My take on it is, and I think you've kind of undercut the length and the importance of the male servant's speech. He gives this very long, well-addressed speech discussing how he was born into freedom and speaking to basically the audience so that we see black people can be born into freedom and they behave like normal human beings. So the 13th Amendment is a non-issue. Right, so you see that side of the character, where I feel that we could see the evils of slavery if there was a little bit longer dialogue between the characters in the female servant. Your take, on the other hand, of the female servant
is that there's a scene later in the movie where Lincoln and the servant are standing out in front of the White House, and it's before the vote on the 13th Amendment, where they're talking about what's going to happen when slavery ends. And they both, neither of them obviously know, and no one at the time would have known what exactly would have happened. And the question that the servant asks is, do you want us to be free? Do you want me to be free? Or what do you think of us? And Lincoln says, I don't know you. I don't know any of you. But I know that before the law, I think we should all be equal. And that's the comment that he makes. And it's, to me, it's one of the better scenes in the movie, and I think if in that moment with the son, if she starts to talk about her past a little bit, I think that scene would have lost its luster.
Right, but...
because Lincoln then gets to know her.
Correct.
And I think it loses it a little bit.
But I feel that that scene or that message could be portrayed just as easily through a third party who is just another black person passing by Lincoln right in the same timing in the movie, and they can address Lincoln and they can know Lincoln and everything about Lincoln, and Lincoln can simply say, I know nothing about you or your people,
right.
And that same message is portrayed.
Yeah, but you would have to know that that person's a slave or was a slave at one point. Because here's a woman who was a slave and now isn't a slave, and she's a free woman working at the White House, and that's an interesting dynamic, right?
Yes.
That she was a slave at
Absolutely.
One point.
Yeah.
So, I mean, you could have someone like a Frederick Douglass type of character who's an abolitionist who was a slave. You could have a meeting there.
Yes.
And to serve that same purpose, you're right, though.
Yeah.
Now, I don't think we can really spoil the movie because...
the ending? Is that what you're wondering?
Yeah. Because... I'm assuming that everybody knows what happened to Abraham Lincoln. So I don't think we can really spoil it, but you and I both agree that, now we won't say exactly what happens at the end, but you and I both agree that there was a point where it could have ended.
It could have ended 15, 12?
Between 10 and 15 minutes earlier, and I was expecting it to end, and I think you said you were.
Yes.
And it doesn't.
No.
And it goes on.
It has
on.
A very awkward pause.
Yeah.
And then the movie goes on.
Yeah.
Do we want to talk about the line?
We can talk about the line.
So the line that Lincoln says whenever he's meeting with his cabinet and he's just been informed that he's late for a meeting with his wife and he's now in trouble, and he's like, oh, I guess I better be on my way, even though I don't want to be.
Mm-hmm. And it's clear where they're going.
Correct.
And so you know what? So you know what's going to happen, and we think that that's where the movie should end. You just see Lincoln walking down the hall slowly, and the sound is really good because you hear the steps and he's walking slowly, and it's really just a very well shot scene. And if that was the end of the movie, I don't think anyone would complain.
I would have been very happy.
Yeah.
Right.
You know, the line, okay, maybe a little cheesy, whatever. And
that was upsetting.
And a little expected, but like I remember there's, from Whose Line Is It Anyway years ago, I don't know why I always remember this, but they did Scenes from a Hat, and one of them was Messages Delivered a Little Late. And Colin Mochrie, he comes out, and he's running. He's like, Mr. Lincoln, the show got bad reviews. So it's like that kind of a joke. And fine, you end the movie that way, and fine. But the him walking out is really nice. But that's not how it ends, and it goes on and talks about some other stuff. But it's just, at 2.5 hours into the movie, if that's the ending, I feel okay.
Yeah, I'm satisfied.
Yeah.
I'm fulfilled.
Yeah. But, you know, Spielberg decided to take it a little longer. And it felt to me a little bit like kind of Amistad-esque in that there's all these political wranglings going on, this back and forth, and trying to get things through the legislative process with this underpinning of there's violence going on outside of these walls. And that's why we have to settle these problems. Obviously, the Civil War is a little different than in Amistad and what's going on in Amistad, but it felt, the tone of it felt the same to me. The only difference was that the John Quincy Adams character in Amistad, the man John Quincy Adams himself, was a little more sarcastic and a little more sharp with his tongue, whereas Lincoln was more the orator who would tell these stories.
Right.
And so the Quincy Adams character I found not as, I don't want to say annoying, but he was quicker to the point, and he was maybe a more entertaining figure than Lincoln is.
So you feel Spielberg's message was to draw out the length of the movie like a Lincoln speech?
Perhaps. Maybe Spielberg is happy that in the last 20 minutes I was suffering.
With a butt cramp because your seat was so uncomfortable?
And I was sweating because it was... And the thing was full, too. I mean, that's obviously a factor. And the guy next to me crushing me and looking at his phone. And
yes.
The last 20 minutes was tough to get through.
It was. Not made easier by Spielberg's extension.
Right, that's why I was like, all right, he's walking down the hall, the movie's over, good, I can stand up now. Oh, no, I can't. Oh, God. So, but overall, okay, so overall impression, what would you give it out of 10?
Out of 10?
Yeah.
For historical significance and information, as a teacher, to use that in a classroom,
yeah.
If my students wouldn't fall asleep, I'd give it about an 8. But in terms of actual viewing...
That gets you through 4 days.
Yeah. It'd be awesome if I was away. But in terms of actual viewing value, I'd say probably a 6 or a 7.
Yeah, I agree with that. For pure entertainment, yeah, probably about a 6. And yeah, if you're looking to study the 13th Amendment or get a historical depiction of it, and it's based off of Doris Kearns Goodwin's book, Team of Rivals. And it does a good job of incorporating her themes of how he crossed the aisle and the different ways in which he got Democrats on board. So, and I'm sure Doris Kearns Goodwin, to some extent, was involved with the writing or even on set and helping develop or help working with the actors to develop the characters. So in that respect, you know, the as a historical representation of it, I think it's pretty good. But in just a let's go out to a movie tonight.
Yeah, I'm not going to do that again.
It won't be on the. It's not on the top of my list.
It's not a review.
There doesn't seem to be a lot of rewatchability.
No.
In it.
No. But in terms of studying the 13th Amendment, as you were saying, it is very well structured. That if you were to use that in a classroom or in any other educational setting, you could chunk out the middle of it. And
yeah. Well, yeah. There's not a lot that's extemporaneous to the idea of the 13th Amendment.
Absolutely not. Yeah.
There really isn't. Some of it gets drawn out a little bit, but that core idea of this is we're passing this amendment, this is what we're doing, that's there for pretty much the whole time.
And the House arguments and debates were very well structured.
Yeah.
They're fun to watch.
Yeah, and they're well shot.
Yeah.
So there's some laughs in there. And yeah. Not terrible. Not great for us. I mean, critics loved it.
Yeah.
A lot of end-of-the-year lists, it's at the top. There's a lot of Oscar buzz around it.
Yes.
So. But, I usually never see the movies that win the Oscars.
No.
So, what the hell do I know? So, there you go. So, thanks for doing this, David.
Hey, my pleasure. Thanks for having me on.
Always. Hey, anytime, my friend. Anytime.
So, there you have it. 3 expert opinions on Downton Abbey, Titanic, Blood and Steel, and Lincoln. If you have any thoughts, comments, questions about the podcast, you can find me, historyslam@gmail.com, also on Twitter, @DrShawneeFever. And until next time, if you're out and you see Enrico Palazzo, please say hi for me.
Thanks for listening to the History Slam podcast. Check out activehistory.ca for more features and articles, and be sure to subscribe on iTunes.